Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Yeah, so first of all, let me thank Tom and Matthias for the great service they are doing to the community. I guess they must be the busiest man of Toronto in this time of the year. And then I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here, for the kind invitation. And I disagree with Monique that she has to do basically nothing, because there are always people whom you have to send several emails before they answer, so there is some work left, even if you can delegate it here to the local organization. And yeah, and I have to admit that I doubt that I deserve this invitation, because I haven't really done much work on game options, and let alone convertible bonds. I've only written two short papers some years ago. And I'm very pleased to be here, and now I'm here, so you have to listen to me. And so I'll talk on pricing game options, or I put this into parentheses, your convertible bonds. I just consider them as a subset of game options from a very general point of view, from an academic point of view. Just want to review some general concepts. What do we mean by pricing these objects? Just to think about the things we think we know or take for granted. This is here the idea of the talk. So first of all, I give a short introduction. What am I talking about? And so what do we mean by pricing? And there will be two big approaches here. Arbitrage-based approach to option pricing, and then utility-based approaches to pricing. And then there are several groups, so let me tell you what I'm talking about in general here. So what kind of options do I consider here? We really want to go for game options, but this is a generalization of standard options, so let's start with the European option. The European option for me is just a random variable, the payoff at expiration, right? So this is the money you get if you have the option. Okay. And then the generalization are the American options. There, instead of the payoff, you have the exercise process, whatever that may be. So you have a random variable at each time. And so if you exercise the option at little t, you get xt. So h for me is the European option, and x is the process, the exercise process for the American option. And conceptually, you can consider European option as a special case of an American option if you say that if you exercise the option before capital T, you get nothing, zero, or even maybe from a theoretical point of view, you get minus infinity, because nothing may be already a lot if the H is allowed to be negative. So something like this, at least theoretically, a European option is a special case of an American option. And then we turn to game options, which have been considered in the literature and in a very seminal paper by Yuri Kiefer, who is here, and maybe one should call it Israeli option because of these geographical names here. So here I called it game option, and there this is again a generalization of American option, where you have the symmetric way to look at things. So both parties can cancel the contract. The exercise process is like in the American case, and the cancellation process is for the seller of the option. So if the seller cancels the contract, then he has to pay U. U is larger than L. L is the thing you get as a buyer, and U is the thing you have to pay as a seller. Okay, and many concrete products can be interpreted as game options, because both counterparties somehow have the right to cancel the contract. Not everything, because here in this framework we can only cancel the contract once, so we don't have multiple exercises, and we don't have a delay in the cancellation process or things that happen in practice. But forgetting about these things, this is pretty general. And again, this includes the American case as a special case, because in the American case this is just the exercise process. L for low is the X, and the U would be infinity. So you don't cancel the contract because you have to pay infinitely much. And so this is, of course, clear. And now the question is, what are fair prices for such products? In what sense? And so we know the conventional wisdom is like this. If you want to do pricing, you should use some equivalent martingale measures or risk-neutral measures. And so what everybody agrees somehow is if you want to price a European option, you take the expectation under some equivalent martingale measure, for the underlying, or in fact for all tradable securities in the market, as we just heard in the previous talk. And if you have an American option, you take the Snell envelope, so the soup overall stopping times of the expectation of the exercise process stopped at tau, so the initial value of the Snell envelope, so to speak. And if you have a game option, this we know now for some years, then you take a Dunking game, the value of a Dunking game, where you have the soup overall stopping times for the buyer, so to speak, and the inf overall stopping times for the seller. And then you have the payoff here. The payoff depends, it can be L or can be U, depending on what happens first. If the buyer exercises, he gets the lower amount. If the seller exercises or cancels, then she gets the larger value here. So conventional wisdom tells you to use these numbers here, and then you can discuss what martingale measure to choose here. But my question here in this general overview talk is why? What is really the reason that you to take these numbers here? So, I mean, really. Okay, and to give answers here, I'm going to be a little more specific about what we consider here. We can distinguish between static and dynamic situation. And I think in textbooks, this distinction is not made clear enough. Because sometimes we have the over-the-counter situation, two parties, and then the contract, the option, exists only twice, when the contract is made and when it expires, or when it's exercised. And in between, the option doesn't exist. There is no market. There is no market price. And then there's a dynamic situation. If you have an American option, say, on a real market, it's liquidly traded, so you have a price all the time. And so this is different. And so if we want to justify why these prices are the right ones to consider, there should be a different reasoning for this static situation and for the dynamic situation, because it's different. And then, of course, we can distinguish whether we have here arbitrage-based prices or different concepts, like the utility-based prices I want to talk about later as well. Okay. So now let's start with the arbitrage-based prices. In a simple situation, the market is complete, so this is what everybody knows. And in a more general situation, we have to argue a little more carefully, and we can, let's consider static and dynamic case. So the complete markets are really the cases where we get the intuition from, right? So this everybody knows here. In the complete market, and starting with a European option because it's simplest, in the complete market, the payoff can be replicated by this amount of money here. You have a unique martingale measure, so this is a number you know. And then this, of course, is the unique arbitrage-based price, because if you pay less for the option, then you have a bias arbitrage, because you can buy the option and sell the replicating portfolio, and if you do it the other way around, then you have a seller's arbitrage. So that's clear, at least from a roughly speaking. I mean, mathematically it's not so obvious, because if you really want to justify these prices by such arbitrage arguments, you have to make sure that your set of admissible strategies is compatible with these arbitrage opportunities, because often in the mathematical literature, the set of admissible strategies is not a vector space. So you may be able to buy the replicating portfolio, but not to sell it, because it's not admissible. And then you're in trouble how to justify these prices. But this is only on a technical level, on a mathematical level, and I don't want to go into this here. So this is clear. How is it with American options? For American options, it's clear that the price must be at least the soup overall the expectations under the unique martingale measures of the option exercised at tau, because if you have the American option, you can take it as the European option which has this payoff, and so it must be worth at least that much, no matter what option, with what stopping time you take. So this is evident. At least you have to pay this from the results of European options. But what is not so clear is that you don't have to pay more, because it could be that American options are worth more than the best implied European-style option. Why is it not true that the value to that the right to exercise the option whenever you want and to change your mind later doesn't have a value in itself, right? So this is not so clear in the first place. Why is it not worth more than the best implied European option? But this we know is true, because for this amount of money here, you can buy a portfolio, namely the Snell envelope, the smallest super martingale, which is under Q, which is greater or equal X. So you buy this portfolio, and whenever, as a seller of the American option, and whenever the buyer comes and says, now I want to exercise my option, then your portfolio, the dynamic portfolio, is worth at least X, and so you're perfectly hedged. So for this amount of money, you're perfectly hedged, so if you get more for the option, then you have a bias arbitrage opportunity. Okay, and so the funny thing here is that you're perfectly hedged even if the buyer is not restricted to stopping times, even if the buyer is an insider, right, who can always stop at the maximum of the profit. Even then, you're perfectly hedged. And so this is fine. Pi is the only reasonable price. And for game options, this is one step ahead. And it has been shown by Yuri Kiefer that we have the same situation, that there's a unique price, and now it's the value of the Dünki game under Q. Right? Because, say, now it's symmetric. In the American case, it's asymmetric. Here, it's symmetric, because if you take minus the option, then inf and sup are reversed. And so from the perspective of a seller, you choose your favorite sigma, this, the best stopping time you can choose, and then you replicate this payoff here, given your optimal stopping time, and or you super replicate this, and no matter what T you have, and then it's again as in the American case, no matter what your counterparty does, even if he or she is an insider, with this amount of money you can construct a portfolio that is enough to cover the expenses you have when the contract is exercised. Okay, so this is why this amount of money here is an upper limit and an upper bound for the no arbitrage price, and by changing the sign, it's also a lower limit because of this inf sup equals sup inf. So this is non-trivial, but this is known from drinking games. Okay, so this is very simple, and now this was the static situation, and in the dynamic situation where you really want to have a whole price process, it's clear that you don't get more, because if you have more trading opportunities, you get fewer prices that are consistent with arbitrage. So if we before we only had one possible price, you still have only one possible price. And so for European options, you do it all at time T, of course. Then you have conditional expectation, and here you have conditional expectations in the Snell envelope, and here the conditional expectations in the Dünki game. Right, so this is the same formulas, essentially. So how do we go about in the non-complete, in the incomplete case? So starting with a static situation. Why are those expectations of the payoff here the reasonable prices in the dynamic situation, or liquid trading? For static trading, but for incomplete situation. So here we could start with dynamic trading. We take the fundamental theorem of asset pricing, telling us if we take a conditional expectation under some martingale measure for all the underlyings, then the option here, dynamically traded, is a martingale as well. So we have a market where everything is a martingale, and so we don't have arbitrage. And if we now restrict trading of the option to two instances, namely in the beginning and the end, then we have fewer arbitrage opportunities. So if even dynamically traded, we don't have arbitrage. We don't have arbitrage either in the static situation. That's clear. So what's not so clear is that why are there not more possible prices? In a dynamic situation, we can only take the expectations here, but in the static situations, why are there not more prices? But this is known from the super-hedging theorem. The super-hedging theorem tells you that for the soup here, of all these prices, these are intervals. This is an interval of prices here, the condition expectations, because it's a convex set of martingale measures. And for the soup, you can replicate, super-replicate the H, the option. And so the seller cannot get more money than the soup of these expectations, because then already he can super-replicate. If he gets more money, he has an arbitrage opportunity. And so from changing sign, because this is symmetric, and from convexity of the set of expectations here, we know that the interval of possible prices is just the interval of expectations here of the tail. So this is also what everybody knows. Now, going to American options and game options, let's go immediately for game options, because it includes the American case. Then, again, what we have to do is we take the value of the Dinkin game, but now we don't know what the Q is, the martingale measure, and so an upper price is the soup overall Q, and it doesn't really matter where you put the soup. This is non-trivial, but it can be shown that you can put it inside or outside, also this soup. And so this is an upper price, and if you take the inf overall equivalent martingale measures, and the rest is here this value from the Dinkin game, then you get a lower price. So what one really has to show or can show, also for game options, but before it has been done similarly by Carazzo and co-authors for the American case, that if you get more than this amount of money, then you have a seller arbitrage. If you get less than this amount of money, you really have a buyer arbitrage, as in the European case. And if you get anything, any amount of money as the seller within these bounds, then you have neither a buyer nor a seller arbitrage. So this is really what one expects. So in a static situation, incomplete situation, this conventional wisdom really makes sense. But, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So for practical purposes, it's too large. Yeah. Yes, because this includes the European case as a special case. So I mean, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So here, this is the difference between academia and practice, right? So no arbitrage is a very weak concept. Riskless gains is such a weak concept that the consequences are small. I mean, we are somehow spoiled by Black-Scholes, where we think that no arbitrage gives a lot of information. You would generally expect that it hardly gives any information, and in an ordinary incomplete market with jumps, it hardly gives any information. That's it, right? Yes? Although, I mean, yeah. But at least you know something, right? I mean, if you model things, you know that whatever model you take, it has to be of this form. And then you can look after how you get your Q. And you can do it by calibration, for instance, right? You let the market tell you what the right Q is. At least this is what the first talk was about. At least you have some theoretical fundament that you know where to look for models. And what in the dynamic? But this was the static situation. How do we argue in the dynamic situations? Why is this set of expectations, or in the dynamic situation, the set of conditional expectations, why is it the right set to consider for dynamic pricing? And for European options, this is really immediate from the fundamental theorem of asset pricing, because We know if we take the conditioned expectations of the payoff under some martingale measure, then this thing is a martingale. Everything else is a martingale as well. So we have a common martingale measure for everything, and then we have no arbitrage. This is fine. This we know. And the other way around, if we have no arbitrage, there must be a common martingale measure for everything. So there must be a martingale measure for the underlying, such that this conditional expectation equation holds for the derivative as well. So it's really immediate that these are the only price processes that work. Okay, and the fine thing is that the initial prices in the dynamic approach coincide essentially with those from the static approach. So it's not that you get a different set of prices in the dynamic or in the static approach, even in the incomplete market situation. How does it work with American or game options? And this I haven't really found considered often in the literature. So if you want to have a dynamic justification of the Snell envelope, say, in a dynamic situation, right, in a market where American options are liquidity trading, or for game options. So why is this this thing here, the value of the Dynkin game under some martingale measure QY, are those the only prices that are consistent with no arbitrage? And why are they consistent with no arbitrage? And so to answer this question, you first of all have to think about what does it mean to trade an American option dynamically. And so here are the key ideas, key assumptions, and one of them is really trivial. So I think the price of an American option or a game option should be in between the lower price and the upper price. Consider an American option. So the price of an American option should always be at least the exercise price. I mean, this is clear. If the American option is cheaper than the exercise price, then you buy it and exercise it immediately. So this is almost trivial, if you want to have this. And in the game option, you have these two bounds. And then the other thing is also not difficult, but this one has to think about this a little bit. So how do you do dynamic trading with an American option? I think nothing is wrong with positive positions. You can buy any amount of American options and keep them in your portfolio. Nobody forces you to exercise it. So trading positive amount of American options is fine. But negative amounts, shorting American options, that's not so obvious, because suppose your trading rule tells you to have minus one American option in your portfolio till capital T. But then you sell this American option to somebody, because you want minus one in your portfolio, and then the somebody comes and says, now I exercise it. But then it's gone. Then your portfolio has zero American options. So because of this exercise right, you may not be able to have constantly minus one American option in your portfolio. So in that sense, trading American options means that you are facing constraints, trading constraints, short sale constraints. But not altogether, because in some situations there is no danger that the option will be exercised. There is a market price. We are in the dynamic situation. And as long as the market price of the American option is higher than the exercise price, probably nobody will exercise it. The market price is 5, exercise price is 4, so why should anybody exercise for 4 if the option can be sold for 5? And even if this somebody exercises the option for 4 and you want to have minus 1 in your portfolio, then you immediately sell an American option for 5 and then you're fine again. So as long as the exercise price of the American option is smaller than the market price, you can have negative amounts of the option in your portfolio, but if they are equal, they can't be the other way around, but if they are equal, then there is this short sale constraint. And for game options, you have it both sides. So you have a short sale constraint if the American option happens to be very cheap, and you have a buying constraint if the game option happens to coincide with the upper bound. So this is the message here, trading American and game options is trading under constraints. And then we have to say what no arbitrage means. We have to define no arbitrage under constraints, the no free lunch with balancing risk condition from the mathematical literature. But this is evident. We just translated. And then we have to reformulate the fundamental theorem of asset pricing under such trading constraints, such random and dynamic trading constraints. So you look in the Delbarn-Schachermeier framework, you go through the steps of the proof, and you see, oh, it all works. You can all do it with under trading constraints. And then you get a little think something which is a little different than martingales or sigma martingales. And starting from that, you ultimately deduce that the only option price processes that are consistent with this notion of no arbitrage under trading constraints are the values of the Duncan games under equivalent martingale measures Q. So this is how you can argue with American or game options in an incomplete situation. There are many technical issues here because equivalent martingale measures, I mean, in the Delbarn-Schachermeier thing, you have sigma martingale measures and problems like this where we have to impose some regularity conditions in order to really get equivalent martingale measures here, but this is a mathematical thing. And so the nice message again is the initial prices, the possible initial prices for American game options coincide with those from the steady case. It's not that you get a smaller interval only because now you have dynamic trading. Okay, this is the no arbitrage theory. So the message is conventional wisdom holds. You just take the formulas from the complete case and take an arbitrary martingale measure. Now I want to talk a little bit on utility-based prices. Motivation being that in an incomplete market situation, no arbitrage doesn't tell you much. You have this, even in the European case, this large interval anywhere from sometimes zero up to the value of the stock for a European call. And so, yeah. And there are two approaches here, the dynamic approach where I want to get whole price processes and the static approach here. So let's start with the dynamic approach. And this is more an academic thing, I would say. So my assumption here is the options are liquidly traded. So this is fine, because this is what I'm up to. And then this is something, 10 years ago I liked this, now I would say it's rather academic. We assume that there is a representative agent, wherever this really comes from, which is an expected utility maximizer with a given utility function U. Okay, and also we assume that, and this is maybe not too bad, that the options are in zero net supply. So if we take the representative agent who owns all the assets in the market, then this representative investor has no options in its portfolio. So any option that is sold by somebody is bought by somebody else. So if you aggregate them, you have no options. So this is maybe okay, but this of course, I mean, for academic purposes may be fine. And although I think that it is reasonable to be an expected utility maximizer, I don't think it's reasonable to assume that everybody is an expected utility maximizer, let alone that they aggregate to somebody who is an expected utility maximizer. But okay, I mean, but in academia, this is not entirely strange assumption, so why not just considering it and see what comes up. And so if we are looking for prices given a fixed utility function such that the options are in the optimal portfolio for the representative investor are in zero net supply, so the optimal portfolio contains zero options, it turns out that there's a unique price process consistent with these assumptions, unique option price process for European option, and this is just as before the conditional expectation of the payoff under an equivalent martingale measure, but now a very specific one. And the martingale measure you have to choose here is the dual minimizer corresponding to the utility maximization problems without options. So you consider the utility maximization problem without option being present, and to such a problem there's a dual minimization problem. And the for equivalent martingale measures and dual minimizer you take here as the measure for the conditional expectation. So for instance, if you have an expected utility maximizer with exponential utility, then you have to minimize the relative entropy. So you take the minimal entropy martingale measure, the martingale measure with smallest relative entropy relative to the given measure, and this is the right measure to choose here. So this is the theorem. In general, it's wrong. Again, you need some regularity because in general, this dual problem, the dual minimizer, needn't even be a martingale measure. It needn't even be a measure because it is a process, and this process is this, the candidate would be the density process of an equivalent martingale measure, but in general, it's only a super martingale. So it isn't even a density process of any measure. So in full generality, you have all these mathematical problems, but yes.
In a typical incomplete market, are there a priori assumptions that you consider in the market, or the indices that will guarantee the representative agent? Or if not, is there a way to check case by case that this assumption
is? That this holds here?
Yeah.
So I'm not an economist, so I don't know in full generality this literature or on the existence of representative agents, but I have the impression that it's this is also more conventional wisdom that somebody like this should exist. It's not so clear when this really holds, even under economic assumptions, under theoretical assumptions, and in practice, yeah. So I don't believe in this, even though I did things like this. So we have this behavior, finance, now all these things, computer experiments, many results telling us that people do not behave this well, even individually, and now to in full information and all this. I mean, who believes all these things, right? So it's hard. But the advantage of this framework is that you end up with a unique price, right? Whether one believes in it is a different story, but even in an incomplete situation, you have a unique price process. And this can be generalized to game options, right, by putting things together. So the key assumptions are as in the European case, including this representative agent here. And again, now for game or American options, we say that the trading means trading under constraints, under positivity or negativity constraints. And then you do the whole business again, and you see there's again a unique neutral option price under some regularity conditions. And now it's the drinking game or the Snell envelope where you take here as the measure, the dual measure coming from the utility maximization problem. So, for instance, the minimal entropy martingale measure. Let's now turn to the other utility based approach, which looks similar because it also involves a utility function, but in fact is very different. Not only the numbers, but also the assumptions. And this, even though it also assumes utility maximization, I think makes more sense, but a different situation. So now we are over the counter, so static situation, and it's asymmetric. So let's suppose that I am the seller, so I want to have a price. I don't, and you are the buyer, I don't worry about what you want. What you want is you want to buy options, say gamma, a number, fixed number of options, you want to buy them, and you come to me and say, do you sell the option? And then I can decide either to sell them or not to sell them. I have only this two possibilities, and of course I will do the trade if you offer me enough money, and I won't do the trade if you don't give me enough money for the options. Okay, and I assume that I'm a utility maximizer, and here for simplicity, I assume that I take exponential utility, and here I think it makes sense, because utility maximization is a reasonable thing, and I'm only talking about me. I can do utility maximization. In the earlier approach, I assume that everybody does it, which is the representative agent, who knows, but I'm doing it. Okay, and then utility indirect pricing, you probably know, means that I will only accept the trade if my utility is better with the option trade than without. This is expected utility. This is gains from trade, initial wealth, gains from trade. So this is the soup overall trading strategies. This is the maximal expected utility if I don't do the option trade. And if I do the option trade, I get the premium pi, but I have to pay the payoff H in the European case. So this is my expected utility. If I do the trade and I have to take a premium pi, which is large enough such that the expected utility is higher, and the threshold, the minimal price, is the indifference price. Okay, and then one can also define a hedging strategy. This is also nice here because in the earlier approach we had no hedging strategy. Here there was no hedging in this neutral pricing. And also here there was also no hedging in the incomplete case. Here, there's no hedging, right? Only in the complete market we have hedging. Here, there's no hedging, and here, neutral pricing, there's no hedging either. But now we have hedging because we can say here's the optimal portfolio without the option, Oh, this is the wrong sign here. And here's the optimal portfolio if we have the option in the portfolio. So the difference is the adjustment to the optimal portfolio due to the presence of the option, due to the presence of gamma options. So I divide it by gamma, and then this is the sort of hedging strategy per option, utility-based hedging strategy. Okay, and in general, one can't say much about the solution here, but for exponential utility, we have nice formulas. The utility inference price can be computed like this. What is this here? Q naught is the minimal entropy martingale measure. The martingale measure which minimizes the relative entropy, H is the relative entropy, relative to the given measure, P. P gamma is a measure, not a martingale measure, a measure with this density, which involves here the option, it's proportional to E to the gamma H. So this is the density of the measure P gamma, which you introduce for technical purposes. And then Q gamma is the minimum entropy martingale measure relative to P gamma as a given measure. And here in the pricing formula, you need the relative entropy of Q gamma relative to P as well. And then you also take here the conditional expectation of the payoff H under this equivalent martingale measure Q gamma. And it turns out that this thing here is the utility indifference price for gamma options. This is the price for one option. Utility inference pricing is nonlinear, so it depends on gamma. If you sell more options, then the price per option is larger because of the risk averseness. So this is known. This is standard, more or less, utility inference pricing. And the question is now, can we do this for American and game options as well? And there is a little bit in the literature, not much, and I want to tell it here because I wanted to have something which is not everywhere in the literature. So the problem is, so the situation is in the European case. I want to know my utility indifference price. And the problem now is that what does utility indifference mean? It means that utility is the same with and without the option. But I don't know my utility if I sell an American option because I don't know your exercise time. I don't know when you will be exercising the option, and so that's a problem. And the way out here, reasonable way out, I think, is a worst case approach. So if I don't know your exercise time, I take the worst thing that could happen, right? So I expect the worst, of course. And then it's really getting difficult in general. Why? Because I don't know. So I expect the worst, but I don't know what exercise time you will take. So if I take my optimal trading strategy to hedge against the risk, I have to choose my trading strategy without knowing what your exercise time is, right? Because I don't know it. But it's not that I don't know it at all, because once you have exercised the option, you know that you have exercised the option. So I have partial information on it. It's not that I have to choose my trading strategy in advance from the beginning till the end, because once you have exercised the option, I know that you have exercised the option, so from the time that you exercise, I can change, and now taking into account this information. So the set of trading strategies that I can choose here for the utility maximization problem is somehow strange. It has to be almost independent of your decision because I don't know it, but not altogether, because I know a little bit about your situation. I know it once you have exercised the option. So so it's difficult, right? And in general, if you take an arbitrary utility function, strange things occur. Then it can really happen that the American option is worth more than all the implied European style options. So if I sell you I'm the seller here, utility indifference pricer, and I sell you a European option of this form here, no matter what stopping time you take or time here, then I charge you for any of these options a lower premium than for this American option, because the American option for me means higher risk because I don't know what you will do, right? And this additional risk means that I have to charge you more, right? So this is different from the complete case or from what we saw earlier. Okay, so this is, for instance, in the PhD thesis of Christoph Kühn. So he has examples there, and these examples happen in for almost all utility functions, unless you take exponential utility. For exponential utility, and only then, we don't have this problem. Then really the American option is worth as much, or the utility inference price is the price of the best implied European style option. And then the indifference equation looks like this. Here I have the expected utility without the option, so here I've took away the soup because the phi naught is already the maximizer here from the earlier slide. And on the left, I take the maximal expected utility. And here, as I said, the set of trading strategies depends a little bit on your stopping time here. But in fact, I know what I will do. Because once you have exercised the option is gone. And then I'm in a market without option, and for exponential utility by dynamic programming or whatever, a little more, I know that once the option is gone, I do what I would have done without option altogether. So this is only for exponential utility. I know that once the option is gone, I do what I would have done without the option, and before I take this different strategy. So things are simpler in this case. Okay, so for exponential utility, we have an equation here, and then the utility inference price is like on the earlier slide, but now I have to take the soup, the worst case, over all your decisions. And now it depends on my knowledge about your decision. If I know perfectly what stopping time you will take, then the utility inference price is lower. If I don't know anything, I have to take your all stopping times, or I'm suspicious that you may even be an insider, so you're not restricted to the set of stopping times, then I may even charge more here. I have to take a larger set of times, right? Okay, so this is utility inference pricing for exponential utility. So you see the structure is similar than for European options, but it's not really straightforward to do everything. Okay, and game options. This is now not much more difficult than American options, because the difficult part for American options is that I don't know your decision, the exercising part. For the game option, there's also my decision of the cancellation time, but this is my decision. And my decision doesn't complicate things. My decision is like choosing my trading strategy. I'm not only choosing my trading strategy, I'm also choosing my cancellation time. So in principle, this doesn't lead to additional problems, and so it only leads to additional complicated expressions here. And we have now soup and inf, because I'm taking the best cancellation price, and I assume that you take the worst stopping time, exercising time, but forgetting about this generalization, the conceptual things were present even in the American case. Okay. A drawback of this utility inference pricing is that it's so hard to compute, right? It's a very difficult problem even to do this expected utility maximization in the presence of a contingent claim, let alone an American or gain option. And then this is difficult. And so one way out to make things simpler is an asymptotic analysis, which for practical purposes may be fine. So we take a perturbation point of view. We consider the utility inference price or inference problem for small numbers of contingent claims. So you don't want to buy 1,000 options from me, you want to buy 5 options from me, small numbers. And for small numbers, I make this linear ansatz here, so assume that the price per option that I sell is some basic price, zeroth order approximation, plus some linear correction, because everything is linear in first order, right? and also the optimal trading strategy. I assume that it is the strategy without option present plus some linear terms. So the ETA is a trading strategy, that's the hedging strategy per option, and this is the price here also per option. Okay, so and if I linearize things, make this linear approximation for European options, then it turns out that things get easier for exponential utility, also for power utility, but not really much beyond. For exponential utility, it's the simplest case. Then in zeroth order approximation, the utility inference price is the conditional, is the expectation of the payoff under the entropy, minimal entropy martingale measure that we have encountered before. And what about the additional risk premium, the risk averseness, if you sell larger numbers of options? This, the correction here is up to a factor 1/2. The minimal quadratic hedging error, if you consider a quadratic hedging problem, so you want to replicate your option as well as you can by dynamic trading with the underlying. This is here initial endowment and gains from trade. And your criterion is the mean square error under the minimal entropy martingale measure. This mean square error turns out to be the correction here for risk averseness. So if the claim is replicable, then the hedging error is zero and the pricing rule is linear. And if the claim is not at all replicable, then you have here a large adjustment if you sell more options. And the optimal strategy, hedging strategy per option, is also this optimal strategy in the quadratic hedging problem. So quadratic hedging turns out to be present here in a utility inference problem in the linear approximation. This is for European options, so this is can be found in the literature, has been studied recently by some authors. But what happens now for game or American options, and this is also not written down anywhere yet, but we have the formulas, we know what happens for utility inference pricing. It looks as for European options, but now we have the soup and the inf here. And now if we do the linearization, we get a similar thing here. So the first zeroth order approximation, the utility inference price, is here again the value of a Dynkin game under the minimal entropy martingale measure, and the correction due to incompleteness, inattainability, is again a quadratic hedging error under the minimal entropy martingale measure, where here for the payoff you take the optimal stopping times from this Dynkin game. Okay, my time is over. Here are some references, just a few somewhat random lists of papers which somehow play a role in this setup. So I thank you for your attention.